the Chairman and my dear brothers and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ and my dear young people. Tonight then we come to the third of our studies concerning the scriptural role of men and women. And of course we come now to the third of these principles that we believe are all to be found in Genesis chapters 1 to 3, the seedbed of the Bible. Such a marvellous thing, brothers and sisters, that God ordained that it should be so. Funny thing, you know, but when I got my very first wide margin Bible, and I was just so excited, it was after a Bible school, and we immediately had a family holiday after the school, and I was determined to do my very first piece of Bible marking. So I took a red ballpoint pen to write the comments in, because everyone else wrote in black, and black was boring, and I decided to write the quotations in green, just to be different, and away I went on, why, surprise, surprise, Revelation chapter 1. And, you know, I don't think I ever did finish the chapter because I was terribly lost as to what it was all about because, of course, I'd started at the wrong end of the Bible. And one of the lessons we learn is that Genesis is a very good place to start with most things, and perhaps that's why God ordained that Genesis is where it is, at the beginning of the story and not the end. So tonight, then, we're going to come to this third principle, that of diversity, and to see, firstly, how that this principle also is to be found in these first three chapters of Genesis. So here we are all over again. We're going to go back now to Genesis chapters 1, 2 and 3 to see this principle. And where are we going to start? Why, surprise, surprise, Genesis chapter 1, verses 26 and 27. Which we've already looked at, of course, in the past, and found that the principle of equality was established there, that the principle of hierarchy was established there, and now we come to a third principle, that of diversity. So let's just see then what the record says. In Genesis chapter 1 and verses 26 to 28, let's read it again as if we've never read it before. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. So God created man, says the verse, and yet the way he created man was to create a male and a female. Now do you know, brothers and sisters, when you stop and think about Genesis 1 and verses 26 and 27, there was absolutely no point to the creative act of forming a male and a female unless their very difference served some purpose, as far as God was concerned. Otherwise, we all would have been androids of some sort, with a sort of, you know, a common set of features, but neither male nor female at all. The very fact that a male and a female of the species were so created argues that that difference was there in the purpose of the Father. So from the beginning, therefore, there was established the principle of diversity, seen in the very subdivision of the species into two forms. Otherwise it wouldn't have been done. So we've got a principle here called diversity, which God has established from the beginning. Now come and have a look at Genesis chapter 2, because you see in Genesis chapter 2 we're told, remember, the story of the formation of the male and the female. And we've already looked at the fact that the order of their formation was of course different. And, well, now look at this. You see, not only are they formed at a different time to each other, but the very formation of the male and the female, which Genesis 2 tells us about, is that God used two entirely different methods, and he uses two different words to describe the formation of the male and the formation of the female. They weren't the same. Now have a look at the two words. So here are the two words. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 7, It says concerning the male, and the Lord God, Yahweh Elohim, formed man. Now the word formed here is the word yatsar, or yotsar, Y-A-T-S-A-R, and it means to mould as a potter. So that's the word used in the divine record concerning the bringing forth of the first male. But that's not the word used to describe the first female, because in Genesis chapter 2 and now verse 22 it says, and the rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man made he a woman. And the word made here is not the word yatsar from verse 7, it's a different Hebrew word. This is the word bana, B-A-N-A-H, and it means to build or to construct as a builder. So the man was moulded from a potter, and the woman was constructed by a builder. And I think that God uses two different words to describe two different methods of forming two different creatures who were different. It argues their diversity, you see, that they were made in entirely different ways. So I've got a summary here which... one of those things where I've only just finished it actually, and so I've got it here. It's really an overhead, but you can't see it, so unfortunately I'm going to have to read it out to you. So all I've got is down one side is a story concerning the formation of the man and the story concerning the formation of the woman. So I'll read this twice, just in case you struggle the first time. The male was formed by the divine potter as an organic creation in himself. He tends towards that which will personally achieve. By the law of independence, he was molded as a creature of individuality. Now listen to the words concerning the woman. The female was made by the divine builder as a unique extension of another. She tends towards that which will mutually reciprocate. By the law of sympathy, she was fashioned as a person of companionship. So shall I read those again? Just once more, so that you can get the balance of those two ideas. The male was formed by the divine potter as an organic creation in himself. But the female was made by the divine builder as a unique extension of another. The male tends towards that which will personally achieve. The female tends towards that which will mutually reciprocate. By the law of independence, the male was molded as a creature of individuality. By the law of sympathy, the female was fashioned as a person of companionship. You see, I think God intended this diversity from the beginning. He used different words to describe different methods to create two entirely different creatures. And it was in the purpose of the Father, brothers and sisters, that wondrous diversity should be there from the very beginning. You know, in Genesis chapter 3, which we had as our reading, we read the story of the judgments upon the male and the female. You might have wondered, by the way, why on earth we read the story of the judgments of Genesis chapter 3. Well, we read them for a very good reason. Because you see, in Genesis chapter 3, and reading from verse 16 onwards, in the judgments that were passed, God brought a measure of sorrow on both the male and the female, and yet what we're going to learn is that he also provided differing endowments to them both that specially suited them to accept the burden of their differing responsibilities. Now, let me show you what I mean by that. Let's look firstly at the responsibility of the man in the judgment story of Genesis chapter 3. So concerning the man, it says in verses 17 to 19, cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread. Now, these are all well-known terms, aren't they? This is the terms of the judgment of the man in Genesis chapter 3. Well, do you know, brothers and sisters, I think there are two interesting things that we can deduce from the Genesis record concerning the responsibility of the man. You see, he was to have a measure of sorrow. And I believe that in the very outworking of that sorrow, he was to fulfill the principle of diversity in the responsibilities that God gave to him. So now, again, I'm going to read you a couple of little summaries, therefore, about the man, and then we're going to follow suit with the judgment on the woman. And I want you to read these summaries carefully and just think about them, because there's more to this than meets the eye. So here's the first one, then. Man is to exercise leadership and thus know the burden of responsibility, but he has been endowed with the power of logic to perform this. Now, before any sister gets upset and says, "Are you implying that women aren't logical?" Let me just tell you that the answer is yes, I am implying that they're not logical. But you'll see why in a moment. All right? Because, you see, men and women think differently. They are endowed with different skills. And one of the skills that a man has been endowed with is the power of logic so that they might exercise leadership. Let me give you an example. It's not a very good one, but you'll see the point. You know, sometimes if a man's given a problem, you say, "Well, how do you get from A across to there?" He would say, "Well, it's easy. You go A plus B, and then across to C, and then move across to D, and that will take you to that point there. After jumping from D, that will take you to that," which is really point E. And he'll show you a logical sequence. And then you'll say to a woman, "How do we get, what do we do in terms of moving from there?" She says, "You've got to go to there." And you say, "Well, how do you know that that's the end result?" Oh, she says, "I just know." And you know, the funny thing about that is she's absolutely right. But she got there a different way, because a woman is endowed with an intuitive skill that a man doesn't have. So I'm not saying, by the way, that all men are logical, because some of them are not. And I'm not saying that all women are illogical. But what I am saying is, as a general principle here, there is an endowment that was given to men that is able to assist them in the burden of the responsibility of exercising leadership in the family, which is what Adam was going to do. And here's another thing, you see, here's the second thing. Man is to make provision. When it says, "In the sweat of thy face thou shalt eat bread," he didn't just sweat to make bread for himself, brothers and sisters. He was to sweat so that he might make bread for the whole family. It's the responsibility of the man to make provision. And thus to know the weariness of effort. But he has been endowed with the blessing of strength to achieve this. And it is true, isn't it, that a man has been given, in terms of his physical frame, generally a greater measure of power and strength. Even today we talk about the breadwinner. Maybe that idea came from Genesis chapter 3, by the way, the phrase "the breadwinner," because it's the man who was supposed to sweat that that bread might be brought forth for the whole family. Now, I like these two words. I like the word leadership and I like the word provision. Because I think provision is a very powerful word. It's a responsibility that a man has. And before a man gets too worried about the fact that he's meant to be the leader, let him also know that he's got responsibility to make provision for his home. He's got to fulfill that responsibility, not just in terms, by the way, of natural bread, but spiritual food. Now it gets interesting. Is he truly the provider for his household? Well, that's what Genesis says that he ought to be. And yet notice how that the man's been given certain endowments to fulfill the very responsibilities that he has. The power of logic, to exercise leadership and the blessing of strength to make provision. These are unique abilities and unique gifts that have been given to man for the outworking of his responsibilities. Now, you know what I've said? Shall I just cover myself again? This is not saying that not all women lack strength, and it's not saying that they don't have certain logical powers, but they are particular blessings that belong, as it were, to the male of the species in, shall we say, a greater level of abundance. Now, just have a look at how that's wonderfully balanced now by the story in Genesis chapter 3 of the judgment on the woman. So look what it says. I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow shalt thou bring forth children. So what did it say concerning the man? In sorrow shalt thou eat bread. But concerning the woman it says, in sorrow shalt thou bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. So you see, both the man and the woman, the woman in Genesis 3, are given a measure of sorrow. And yet I believe that in the very outworking of that process of sorrow was to be seen and found the particular responsibilities that they would have according to the law of diversity that God established from the beginning. So what do we know concerning women then? Well, by the way, you'll appreciate that when I speak to a mixed multitude such as this, comprising both male and female of the species, that these words have been chosen with some considerable care, because, you know, otherwise, well. So, woman is to give support and thus to know the pain of empathy. But she has been endowed with the skill of intuition to fulfill this. Tell me a woman that doesn't understand this, or show me one. And by the way, these principles have got nothing to do with whether a woman is married and whether she brings forth children. They are natural endowments of womankind that are part of the diversity that God has blessed them with from the very beginning. Now, is this implying that all men lack intuition? No, it's not. But what it's saying is that a woman has a greater abundance of it. It's just there. She has that. It's one of the things that she's been gifted with in order that she might provide that spirit of support. She has a certain intuitive skill that a man lacks. You know, in ecclesial life, my wife will say to me, I don't think so-and-so's going too well at the moment. I didn't notice. Why is it that a woman notices these things? Well, they just do. Because they're built that way. It's part of the endowment of God, isn't it? It's a wonderful thing. It's part of that diversity. A woman is to provide nurture and thus know the anxiety of care. But she has been endowed with the gift of emotion to accomplish this. Have you ever heard of a family where there's not enough money to buy two pairs of shoes, and mother needs shoes and one of the sons needs shoes? Guess who gets the shoes? The son. Because the woman will sacrifice, won't she? It's part of the spirit of nurture that's built in her. She doesn't have to stop and think about it, she just does it. She's got this warmth and caring spirit, this flood of emotion that isn't always there in a man. Now, you see, by the way, brothers and sisters, because I think this is really interesting, that you see the very strengths of a woman might also be her weaknesses, and the very strengths of a man might be his very weaknesses. There are times when women become emotional, and when they do, if they become overwrought with emotions, all logic flies out the window. It doesn't matter what you say, you're going to lose the argument. Because they've reached that point of no return. Now you see my point, brothers and sisters, that's just one of the realities of life, and yet that's part of the very blessing that God has given to the woman. But you see, there are other situations where a man is too analytical. He's utterly logical, but he lacks sensitivity and care, and he blunders into situations and causes all sorts of trouble because he didn't have the wit or brains to figure out what he was doing, and a woman would have handled it with a lot more care and discretion. So his very strength can also be his weakness. But you see, to me, there's something absolutely beautiful about all this, that these are divine endowments of diversity. We live in a world, brothers and sisters, that's gone mad. And part of the madness of the world is to suggest that men and women are the same, that they're utterly the same. They're not the same, brothers and sisters. They never were the same. And God planned that there should be diversity between the male and the female from the beginning and blessed us with special gifts. We never want to give those away because the world says we're all the same. We're not. You see, little children and little boys play with little boys' toys. Most little boys don't play with dolls, even if you gave them dolls. One or two might, but most don't. And most little girls don't run around making car or rocket noises. From the very beginning, they're different. Well, I believe that Genesis is telling us this, you see, and that there are marvelous blessings that both the male and the female have been blessed with as part of the principle of diversity that God established from the very beginning. Oh, I think that's interesting. Now, come and have a look at the law of Moses then, because now have a look at Leviticus chapter 12 and the law concerning childbirth. So let's see if we can find now the principle of diversity elsewhere in the scriptural record. Well, in Leviticus chapter 12, we have a strange chapter on childbirth. And this is what it says. So Leviticus 12, I think we'll read from verse 1 down a few verses here. Yahweh spake unto Moses, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, saying, if a woman have conceived seed and born a man-child, by the way, that word man-child is the same word as male in verse 7. This is the law for her that hath born a male or a female. So the word man-child in verse 2 is the same as the word male in verse 7. Well, if she's born a male, says verse 2, then she shall be unclean 7 days. According to the days of the separation for her infirmity shall she be unclean. And in the 8th day the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised, and she shall then continue in the blood of her purifying 33 days. She shall touch no hallowed thing, nor come into the sanctuary, until the days of her purifying be fulfilled. But if she bear a maid child, which by the way is the same word translated female in verse 7, if she bears a female, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks as in her separation, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying 66 days. But when the days of her purifying are fulfilled for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring a lamb of the first year for a burnt offering, and a young pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation unto the priest, who shall offer it before Yahweh and make an atonement for her, and she shall be cleansed from the issue of her blood. This is the law for her that hath borne a male or a female. Do you know, brothers and sisters, I believe that this law acknowledged the principle of diversity. Now, by the way, it's the mother who's unclean, not the child. Right? It's the mother who is unclean. And yet the purification ritual obviously relates in some way to whether the newborn child was a male or a female. Now, one of the questions of Leviticus chapter 12, by the way, is that you'll notice that the times of purification for the two were different. Did you notice that? So it says concerning the male in verse 2, that firstly she was unclean 7 days, and then she had in verse 4 another 33 days to continue in the blood of her purifying. Whereas if it was a female, she was to be unclean, verse 5, for 14 days, and was to continue in the blood of her purifying for 66 days. Now the question of Leviticus 12 is, was the time for the male half that of the female, or was the time for the female twice that of the male? What thinkest thou? In other words, one of these two must be the standard measurement, and the other one is either double the standard or half the standard. So the question is, of course, well, which one then is the standard? Well, I think that the standard, by the way, is the male. And I think so for several key reasons. The first thing is that you see, in the sequence of this chapter, the male is mentioned first, and he appears to set the benchmark of the time period, followed in verse 5 by the word but, meaning that now there is a change, a deliberate change for the female. So it says, if she has a male, then that will be the periods, but if it is a female. The second thing is, what's the total period of purification for the male? 7 days plus 33 days equals, why, 40 days. Now, 40 days is a recognized symbol, isn't it, in the Bible, of a period of probation. Genesis 7 verse 4, Numbers 14 verse 33, Ezekiel 4 verse 6, Jonah 3, etc., etc. So 40 days is a known symbol of a period of probation in the scriptural record, and that's the total period of purification relating to a male child. Now, whereabouts is it? In Leviticus chapter 15 and verse 19, which we don't need to turn up particularly, it says that if a woman have an issue, and her issue in her flesh be blood, she shall be put apart 7 days. So what the law taught was that the standard period of uncleanness for any issue of blood was 7 days. So we assume, therefore, that the 7 days of Leviticus chapter 12 and verse 2, following the birth of a male child, is in fact the standard period, or part of the standard period. So, of course, you know what's significant about all this story is, you see verse 4, it says, she shall continue in the blood of her purifying 33 days. Verse 6, and when the days of her purifying are fulfilled. So, you see, the blood of the purifying was for 33 days, and the woman came, and a sacrifice of atonement therefore followed on, why, the 34th day. Now, the 34th day answers to Christ's offering in his 34th year. So the atoning sacrifice of Leviticus chapter 12, we believe, has a symbology attached to it, and it's related to the work of Christ and the sacrifice of Christ. Now look, brothers and sisters, unfortunately, our job tonight is not to expound Leviticus 12, but let me just say this, that hidden in the story of the male and the female here is the story of Christ and the bride of Christ, the male and the female. And that for certain reasons, their cleansing periods are different. I'll leave you to think about that, because it's quite an interesting parable that's being outworked here. But the principle of Leviticus 12 is this, that it's based on the principle of diversity, because the whole significance of the ritual rests on the diversity of the male and the female and what they represent in symbol. That's the very basis of why this particular chapter, we believe, is set forth in the law. So the law celebrated the principle of diversity between the sexes. Go and have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 22. Now, in Deuteronomy chapter 22, you'll remember that there is a passage about wearing clothes. And again, we're not going to look at the subject in detail, but I'm just going to make one particular point about the passage. In Deuteronomy 22, in verse 5, it says, "The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto Yahweh thy God." Now, I'm going to read just a short extract for you from Keil and Delitzsch, good German-sounding exposition of the Old Testament record. And this is what Keil and Delitzsch have to say about this verse. As the property of a neighbour was to be kept sacred in the estimation of an Israelite, so also the divine distinction of the sexes, which was kept sacred in civil life by the clothing particular or peculiar to each sex, this was not to be less but even more sacredly observed. The immediate design of this prohibition was not to prevent licentiousness or to oppose idolatrous practices, but to maintain the sanctity of that distinction of the sexes which was established by the creation of man and woman, and in relation to which Israel was not to sin. Every violation or wiping out of this distinction was unnatural and therefore an abomination in the sight of God. So what we're saying, brothers and sisters, is that whatever Deuteronomy might mean, and there might be several layers of meaning, but at the very heart of the law of Deuteronomy 22 and verse 5 was a recognition of the diversity between the sexes that was to be preserved, said the law. And anything which confused or blurred the distinction between the two was deemed as abhorrent to God. So it's the principle of diversity, isn't it? The law upheld that principle of diversity between the two. Well, I was going to deal with some more things in the Old Testament record, but I see that our time is moving on. So let's just go to the New Testament now, and to the 1st of Timothy in chapter 3, and to the Apostles' teaching upon the role of the male and the female in the very heart of ecclesial life. And let's see what he says now in this context. So in the 1st of Timothy chapter 2, we have, in fact, the Apostle's consideration of the role of the man and the woman in ecclesial activities themselves. And I believe that in this chapter he celebrates these same principles of diversity. So here's what he says. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8. He says, "I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting." Now, do you know that Psalm 134, verses 1 and 2, tells us that it was the priests who lifted up their hands in the holy place. Why did the priests lift up their hands? They lifted up their hands in prayer, brothers and sisters. And so when it says that holy hands are to be lifted up here, in the 1st of Timothy chapter 2 and verse 8, I believe that what it's saying is that the men are being assigned here with the priestly role, after the manner of the priests of the Old Testament record. Now, the Diglot translates verse 8 as follows. "I appoint therefore the men to pray in every place." You notice how that's slightly different to the Authorized Version? "I appoint therefore the men to pray in every place." So what he's saying is that this responsibility of prayer is something that peculiarly is given to the men in ecclesial life, wherever they might be. And by the way, the word men here is an interesting word, because you see, Paul's very careful with the words he uses. He doesn't use the word anthropos here, which is a word meaning mankind. Why would he not use anthropos when he says, "I will that the men pray everywhere"? Why wouldn't he use the word for mankind, anthropos? Because the word mankind is wide enough to embrace the male and the female of the species, and so it wouldn't be clear what the apostle might be meaning. Nor does he use the word adelphoi, which means both men and brethren, because the word brethren is also a term that embraces the male and the female of the species. In fact, the male and the female in ecclesial life. Which, by the way, is something to remember, brethren, because when we talk about brethren and sisters, we really shouldn't, because brethren already includes sisters. We should either talk about brethren, which is the term embracing both brothers and sisters, or we should talk about brothers and sisters, but not brethren and sisters. It's confusing. So he doesn't use the word adelphoi either. The word he uses here is the word andros, which means a male, and only a male. And the word he's going to use for the word woman is gunair, which means a female. So the apostle is clear in what he says here, that the words that he's about to bring forth concern the respective roles of the male and the female in ecclesial life. So he says the first thing is, he says the males have the responsibility of priestly intercession in every place, the role of prayer. Prayer, of course, is in itself an act or a symbol of worship. And so the men are to exercise that spiritual principle of leadership in ecclesial life. But they've got to lift up holy hands, says the record. And they've got to do so without wrath and doubting. They've got to have their emotions under control. They've got to be God-centered in what they do. They mustn't be moved by feelings towards other people. Their focus should be on the spiritual role that they are performing. But it is the males that do it, says the Apostle Paul, concerning the leadership principle of prayer. And then verse 9 says, in like manner also that women adorn themselves in mock... Oh, now we went too fast there. Did you notice how it starts, that verse? I love this. In like manner. Oh, now that's a very important phrase, because you see, what that phrase is saying in like manner is that whatever the sisters do in ecclesial life, it might be different, but it's done according to the same spirit of the truth. It's not that they're inferior, brothers and sisters. It's just that they are performing a different role, and a role for which they have been endowed specially by the Father. But both the male and the female are to give themselves to the service of the truth in the same spirit of dedication, in like manner, says the Apostle. Manifested in a different way, but with the same underlying attitude of service in the Father's eyes. So what does he say about the woman then? Well, he says that they shouldn't adorn themselves with costly apparel, but in fact the focus of the woman, verse 10, should be on good works. Good works, says the Apostle Paul. Now, I'd like you just to hold your hand in Timothy and come back to Proverbs 31. Now, you remember that Proverbs 31 is that famous chapter on the virtuous woman, or at least the second half of the chapter. And I just want to draw your attention to something about Proverbs 31 and the virtuous woman in terms of the emphasis that's given in this particular chapter to what she says and does. Now, I want you to see the key word concerning the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31. Verse 13, she worketh willingly with her hands. Verse 16, she considers a field and buys it, and with the fruit of her hands she plants a vineyard. Verse 19, she layeth her hands to the spindle, and her hands hold the distaff. Verse 20, she stretcheth out her hand to the poor, yea, she reacheth forth her hands to the needy. Verse 31, give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. So the notable feature of the virtuous woman in Proverbs 31 is that her hands are associated with the bringing forth of good works in the spirit of care for others in the household. So now come back to Timothy, because in effect you've got two sets of hands here, you see. You've got one set of hands that's lifted up for spiritual provision in the household. The hands of the man lifted up in prayer. But the woman's hands are lifted up in the spirit of support and nurture, that they might bring forth those good works in like manner. So each was to perform a certain role for which they were especially suited. The woman was to provide nurture and support, the man is to provide leadership and provision. And now the apostle goes on to talk about, verses 11 and 12, he says, "Let the woman learn in silence with all subjection. I suffer not a woman to teach, nor to usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence." Now, when he says this, by the way, in verse 12, he says that she is not to usurp authority. And the Greek word means literally to act of oneself, to be absolute master, to take the initiative, to assume the responsibility. So the woman's not to do that in ecclesial life. She's not to take the initiative. Now, why is she not to take the initiative? Why is she not to assume the responsibility or to be absolute master? Because it breaks the principle of hierarchy. It's not that she doesn't make a contribution to ecclesial life, and she does so according to the talents that she's gifted with, but in a different sphere, so that the principle of both equality and hierarchy and diversity are all brought to bear in the fabric of ecclesial life. Now, notice what it says, by the way, at the end of verse 12, when it says that she's not to usurp or teach, she's not to teach or usurp authority over the man. It actually shouldn't be the man, it should be a man. The definite article is not there. So when it says she's not to teach a man, by the way, this is not about husbands and wives, is it? It's just about men and women in the context of ecclesial life. So we believe that what verse 12 is saying is that a woman is not to teach a man in the ecclesia. She's not to teach a man in the ecclesia, that is, a brother. And she's not to do that because, of course, as we've said, it cuts across the principle of hierarchy. And now he gives his scriptural basis for his argument. Verse 13. And so he says, well, look, it's really Genesis 1, 2, and 3. And that's where he's going to take his argument from yet again. So Paul is unaffected by social custom or personal opinion. He goes back to the reasoning of Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Because he says, verse 13, "For Adam was first formed, then Eve." So he brings forth the facts of creation. And then he brings forth the facts of the fall. Verse 14, "Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression." And by the way, the word deceived here in verse 14 concerning the woman is that she was completely deceived. See, that one of the reasons why the woman was deceived is because that power of logic which the man has been endowed with is not quite the same with the woman. Now, in case you think, by the way, that verse 14 is saying, look, it was all the woman's fault from the very beginning, I don't think it's saying that at all. I think that what Paul is saying in the 1st of Timothy chapter 2 and verse 14 is that, in fact, he doesn't exonerate Adam at all. What he's saying is that they both failed, but for two different reasons. Both Adam and Eve fell in the garden, but for two different reasons. Eve was intellectually deceived. Adam was emotionally beguiled. They fell for two different reasons. And if we are to say, well, how did it happen? Well, we know what the answer is, because Eve usurped the authority of her husband. She led, she spoke, and Adam hearkened, but he failed to correctly instruct his wife. Just hold your hand in Timothy and come back to the record in Genesis again, because what did go on in Genesis here? Well, I know there's been all sorts of reasons, but one possible suggestion that's been made, which may have a grain of truth in it, is this. That, you see, when the man was given the commandment in Genesis 2 and verse 16, it said that the Lord God commanded the man, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof thou shalt surely die. And the commandment was given quite clearly and decisively to the man. And yet, when the woman quotes the commandment in chapter 3, she has presumably received the commandment from Adam. She wasn't there when the commandment was given. Now, when the woman quotes the commandment in Genesis 3, verse 2, she says, the woman said unto the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, ye shall not eat of it. And then she adds these words, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. Now, the commandment never said that. The commandment given to Adam never said that. So why did Eve say that in chapter 3? And one suggestion has been, is because Adam imperfectly instructed his wife concerning the commandment. And you see, they were two quite different things, weren't they? The one was the commandment itself that said, you must not eat the tree. If you do eat the tree, you will die. Why would they die? Because they would die as a consequence of disobedience. But when Eve quotes the commandment, she says, don't you touch that tree. There is something wrong with that tree. And the reason for death is different, isn't it? There is poison attached to the tree, as it were. That's not what the commandment was about. Now, it may be that that was Adam's fault, because it would be his responsibility to instruct his wife. And maybe that's part of the reason why Eve fell in the way she did when the serpent reasoned with her. So coming back to the first of Timothy and verse 14. When it says that Adam was not deceived, yes, well, he might not have been deceived, but he still failed to do the right thing. And so the whole point of the judgment of the first of Timothy chapter 2 is to basically set in order principles that arise out of the story of the Genesis record. So I think that what verse 14 of the first of Timothy 2 is teaching is this, that God's ruling in the garden is the basis of the apostles' judgment now, and that is this, that from henceforth Adam's sons have been required to do what Adam failed to do, and that is to spiritually instruct their women properly, and that from henceforth Eve's daughters have been required to do what Eve failed to do, and that is to listen to God's word spoken by their menfolk. So what Paul is doing here is establishing or reaffirming the principles of the judgment of Genesis chapter 3. And then he goes on to say this, verse 15. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with sobriety. So now this is a very interesting verse, because I think it takes us back to this whole principle, you see, of diversity. Now, when it says, notwithstanding, she shall be saved in childbearing, again, there's been a number of different meanings attributed to what this verse could be. One suggestion is that it means that she shall be saved in spite of childbearing. Well, it can't mean that, can it? Because there are some godly women who lose their lives in bearing children. So it's not true that all women are saved in spite of the difficulties or dangers of childbearing. And some ungodly women bear lots of children and do have safe passage through the whole experience. And not only that, but the word saved, you see, that's as it's used in the book of Timothy here, in the first chapter in verse 15 and in the second chapter in verse 4, clearly has to do with salvation itself. The matter of salvation is somehow bound up with this principle of childbearing. So, no, I don't think it means that she shall be saved in spite of childbearing. Then another suggestion has been that she shall be saved on account of childbearing. But you see, what that implies is that in some way childbearing in itself is meritorious for salvation. And that can't be right, because what that does is it imputes inferiority to the unmarried woman or to the childless wife. And there is no inferiority, so it can't mean that she's saved on account of bearing children, because some women don't, and yet they can be thoroughly godly. And then another suggestion, which is a very interesting one, is that it means she shall be saved by means of the childbearing, and the definite article is there in this verse in Timothy, and that the childbearing here is a promise of the coming seed of the woman to come. Well, it's a very attractive idea, but by the time Paul writes the first of Timothy, chapter 2, in verse 15, the promised seed has already come, and only one woman was involved in bringing him forth, and although it is true that all women are saved through that child, well, so are all men. So that wouldn't be anything special concerning the woman here, and yet clearly verse 15 is talking about something that the women do that relates to the principle of their salvation. Now, I think that the actual meaning of verse 15 is this. Well, in fact, you notice what it says. Notwithstanding, she shall be saved if they continue. It begins with one woman and then reaches out to embrace all of womankind. She shall be saved if they continue. Now, what do you think, therefore, that this business of childbearing is that the apostle is talking about? Well, I think that he's talking about Genesis chapter 3 and verse 16. Why, surprise, surprise. Now, hold your hand in Timothy and just come back to that for a minute. You see, I think that what he's talking about is the whole sphere of her operation in ecclesial life is based on the principle of her diversity. Now, you remember what it said in Genesis 3, verse 16. Unto the woman he said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow shalt thou bring forth children. The Revised Standard Version says, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. Your pain in childbearing. When Paul says she shall be saved in the childbearing, I think that the childbearing that Paul has in mind is the childbearing principle of Genesis 3 verse 16. And I don't think he's talking about bearing children. I think he's talking about that whole spirit of maternal instinct that is planted into the woman. Remember, as we had it here in terms of this business here, that you see, a woman has been blessed with certain principles of both empathy. She appreciates the principle of empathy, and she knows the anxiety of care. She doesn't want to, but she can't help it. Every woman is endowed with that principle of maternal instinct. She doesn't have to have children for that to be the case. But it does work when you have children. You know, you have a teenage son who goes out to CYC, and he promises faithfully to be home at 11:30, and mother and father go to bed at 11. Well, of course, you know what happens. Father goes straight to sleep. Mother tosses and turns and tosses and turns until she hears the key in the lock that says that boy's home. She can't help it. It's the way she's built. That childbearing, nurturing instinct is there. And I think that that's the spirit that the apostle's talking about here, because you see, every woman has that ability. It's the spirit of nurture and care. And what he's saying is that she should fulfill her responsibilities in ecclesial life. She has equality with the man, but the sphere of her labours in which she exercises herself in the context of ecclesial life should be in those principles of succour and support, of cherishing and consoling, of showing affection, of nurturing good, of offering rest, of extending hospitality, of washing the feet of the saints. There's a whole nurturing role of childbearing that she must fulfil if she is to find salvation. You know, the Apostle Paul, rather, here, is very balanced in what he says, brothers and sisters, because, you see, he goes through these principles. He talks about the role of the male, the role of the female, the diversity between them, the judgment of Genesis, and then he says, verse 15, notwithstanding. And I think that the force of the word notwithstanding is that she has equality of salvation with a man. Of course she'll be saved, just like a man, but this fear of activity is different. And a man and a woman should seek to fulfill those different spheres of activity in the context of their work and ecclesial life. So let's summarise then what we've discovered concerning this third principle now out of Genesis. Man and woman were endowed with differing characteristics that enable them to fulfill differing responsibilities in their work in God's service. This diversity of attribute and skill is to be celebrated. You know, brothers and sisters, if we can do just that, to celebrate that diversity and to rejoice before Almighty God that we know that He did create male and female and that He did create them differently, and to be so thankful to the Father that we are different, that in the context then of ecclesial life, we will have this marvellous multiplication of spiritual activity with the male and the female contributing according to their respective skills. Ecclesias will grow when these principles are understood and practiced in ecclesial life. And how that should be done is the subject of our study tomorrow night.